The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 31st, 2026. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. Well, yesterday we had a kind of a potluck dinner here, I guess. And it was good to meet some new people, some of the younger folks here now who I haven't gotten so quickly acquainted with, but it's good to talk with some of the young folks here. Anyway, I confessed to them that I didn't have a talk for today. So I just thought maybe they could help me. I just asked if anybody had a question, you know. So, and then Tate came up with a very interesting question. Well, yeah. Kind of a question in there, and that's what I want to talk about. And then also Jasmine added a few very subtle comments that run quite deep. I don't know how deeply we can explore that this morning, but I'm going to just say a little bit about what it was. Tate had mentioned that he has seen in the literature and also in various places that we talk about trust. I think that's what it was, yeah. Particularly here, I would use that word trust more than something like belief. Generally, I try to avoid that term, belief, particularly when it comes to Buddhist teachings and understandings, because this isn't about believing something. But we find that, you know, even in our literature, I've seen published books talking about the 10 precepts, where I've seen them, they're referred to even as the 10 commandments of Buddhism or something like that. And these are not the precepts are not commandments. They're not beliefs. They're not gripped ideas. All that's going on with the precepts is just reminding us that one who is awake to what is taking place here, well, they don't lie, they don't steal, they don't do these various things that we can do so casually and easily and not even realizing that we're doing them. It just means that to the extent in that moment, if you're speaking in a way where you're intending to deceive someone else, you might be saying something that isn't true, but you don't realize that you think it is. And that's one thing. It's another thing when your intention is to deceive. So the precepts are nothing more, and of course they don't say that, well, you're a sinner, you're bad, you're going to hell or something if you violate these precepts. If you're just pointing out that one who's awake, you would avoid this, you don't do this. That's all. Just kind of a reminder. It's not a commandment, it's not an order, nor is it something that you believe, because you might end up then forming a belief like, well, then lying is wrong, or it's bad, or I'm a bad person if I speak ill of others, or, you know, the various precepts that we have. So if we get into talking about things of this sort, and we're talking about awareness, and we might be talking about, again, the word that you used, what was it? Faith, yes. Faith, that's the word I want. That's what I want to talk about. Because, yeah, you had mentioned that that we do find faith in Buddhism. It's mentioned here and there. But as I was saying, on occasion, it ends up even going further than that and saying belief. Because we so easily, well, in the minds of most of us, belief and faith are kind of synonymous, interchangeable. Well, to the awakened, there's quite a distinction here. And an awful lot rides on it, on not being confused about this or puzzled by this. And as I said, even in Buddhist writings, I've stumbled on them where you have just the wrong idea there, but if we're talking about Buddhist beliefs or something like this. But we can have faith, but faith doesn't have to mean belief. The problem is that most of us, we do have beliefs, and then we trust that. We put our faith in that. And that's where we go wrong. And we do it to such an extent that, that our faith is in what we believe or what we think is true, that then faith and beliefs kind of become the same thing. But in Buddhism, and I don't use the term faith too often because it needs to be explained in the way that I'm trying to put it out there now, that this is something quite distinct from a belief. Because a belief, you can put your faith, your trust in a belief, but a belief is, it's necessarily not true, not in any ultimate sense. It could be in a relative sense, relatively true, something you might believe, but it is not truth. Truth absolute, or truth we might write down with a capital T. Now I'm rubbing up against, this is Nagarjuna's teaching here, where he speaks of the two truths. Most of us probably have never encountered this or even thought about it. But this is pretty central to Nagarjuna's teaching, which is very much enlightening or opening up what the Buddha's insight and what that is and what it is that the Buddha saw. And it has very much to do with this. But a belief, you see, it's something you think. It's something you can have an idea about. It's a concept. And the problem is, too, within a lot of our religious communities, even within a particular sect, there'll be differences, perhaps, of beliefs. Maybe slight differences or great differences. I encountered somewhere recently that it sounded like about 50% of all people is roughly that, pretty much 50-50. Not quite, I guess. I don't know what side was slightly heavier than the other, but most people, half of us have had religious experiences. What they were determining were religious experiences. I never felt that I ever had a religious experience from far back as I can remember. And even after I got involved with Buddhism and learning this way, I never thought of myself as a religious guy. Though I remember a very dear cousin of mine who was older and wiser than me, but she's still with us, she's 96 now. But she told me once she thought I was the most religious person she had ever met. And I thought, well, I don't believe anything in particular. I didn't feel like I've had any religious experience. And at the time, I just denied it, I didn't think of myself as an atheist, though for a brief time, I thought maybe that's what I was. But it didn't take me long to realize, it took me longer to figure out why I was uncomfortable with that. But it has to do with belief. That means that I believe there's no God. I don't even know what we're talking about when we say something like God. What exactly is that? But this is the sort of thing that people will put their belief in, and then their faith, their trust in that idea, that belief. But of course, they're all different. They're not just different between, say, different kinds of, Islam and Judaism and Taoism, we'll name them all. And it's not different, but even differences within, just in Christianity alone, but of course we have Protestants, we have Catholics. There's differences there. And then even certainly on the Protestant side, there's all kinds of different sects and, synods and things that have broken out, all differing in their beliefs to some extent. Baptists believe in, they don't believe in infant baptism, so you have to be conscious and aware of what you are and what you're doing and all of this before you can be baptized and that sort of thing. So there's differences of all kinds, you see. And amongst all of us who, half of us have had religious experiences and half of us have not, I realize now that I have had some profound religious experiences, all the while not even having a sense, no religious experience. It was because in my case, actually, it was so quiet and so subtle, I just sort of didn't really know. I noticed it, but I didn't realize just what this was. And it had nothing to do with what I believed. That was the time when I finally realized what it was. But even there, I still didn't think of it as a religious experience. Maybe another 20 years before I started to realize, I think that's what that was. But some of us know this experience. Even some atheists can know this experience. Of course, believers of all sorts, but half of us will have this kind of an experience. Others might go along with a particular belief or a system of belief or whatever, not really having had such an experience themselves, or like myself, where I didn't recognize that I've actually had an experience, multiple experiences of this. But the point is, I think what happens is that if you have an experience of this sort, whether you even remember or recognize it or not, it's going to be kind of, if you're going to say anything about it or try to describe it, it's going to be yours alone. It's your direct experience that you had or are having or live with on a moment-to-moment basis. And it'll probably differ maybe slightly with other people that are close to you or in the same religious community or whatever, or even greatly, even amongst those folks, but certainly among the population of the world, where if it is true that half of us have had religious experiences. But what is the religious experience? And then we'll come up with all kinds of ideas to explain this, or imagery, or images of various things, or even inventing a term like God. And then we can interpret that in all sorts of ways. I mean, the old man with a white beard floating around on a cloud kind of an idea, all the way up to, I've once heard it described as the holy other. Seems fairly abstract, but what exactly is it? And all the things in between. And whether God wants you to be baptized as an adult or as an infant, all this stuff. And we might be holding a view about, say, the experience we've had or think we haven't had or maybe haven't had. And we can argue and fight about this. And it isn't just this matter of religious experience or not. This is about everything. Our politics, our cultures, our languages, the differences that go on between us. And that to the extent that we believe some aspect of it, whatever it might be, and there's others who are thinking differently, we are setting the grounds for us to fight and to squabble, sometimes to a great extent, and other times maybe just to be disgruntled a bit. And this can go all the way down to just our interactions with people we know on a day-to-day basis. It can even go all the way down to matters that are taking place within our own mind, kind of struggles and arguments with that. But the thing that we have in common with all of this is belief, which is the simple definition I'm using here, that I'm trying to lay out here then, is that which we think is true. You can think something, but you don't think it's true. It's just an idea, and you know that, okay. But if you got an idea, a concept, even a sense, maybe kind of vague, the holy other or whatever, but you have a concept here, and then you put a label on it. That's the thing that we will fight over. That's the thing that will squabble, or even within our own mind, disturbing our own mind to some degree where we can't really settle down to that settled place, that peaceful place. This is where the Buddha was pointing to something like this. and Nagarjuna really clarifies it then, that this isn't some particular thing or an idea or a concept. And really what it comes down to, it is nothing to grasp because you cannot grasp it, which now might make it sound like we're talking mysticism or something like this. It's vague. No, it's not. This knowledge, this experience, whether it's a religious experience or not, let's not put labels on it, though. It's just, but we all have this, even if we say we don't, we have this experience. But what is it? Many of us very easily get in touch with this very quickly, say if we're up in the Boundary Waters or I've certainly spent a lot of time up there. On a beautiful night, say, no wind is very, and the sky is clear, stars out there, the Milky Way. And we can look at, we've all experienced things like this. And they don't have to be spectacular, though, but we look at it. And this is maybe a sense of, are we going to label it now? A sense of awe. Okay. If you watch, because I've done this now, when I finally started to understand this quite a few years ago now, and just looking at my mind, just without trying to say anything to myself, but just looking at the shifting feeling, I could see how applying a word to it, say the word awe, immediately kind of boxes something up here. And it changes it, it diminishes it in some way. There's some boundaries there now. Now it's possible to bump up against other kind of things that have been boxed away as well. This isn't bad that we do it. We need to conceptualize the experience. But here's another term Nagarjuna uses. We don't see the emptiness of the things that have been boxed. It's not the nothingness. There they are. They're not nothing. But if we don't realize their true nature, which is they're empty of any kind of intrinsic substance, own being, is the term they would use. Svabhava in Sanskrit. But they're without this. And we can see that. Still, we might need the concept of this or that. And again, I was going to say, too, that it doesn't have to be this old under a starry sky or something like that. But even as David mentioned, I've told this story, where it was nothing more than I just looked at my hand. With nothing, I was actually reaching for a book on a bookshelf, and in a glance, I wouldn't use the term awe. What I realized pretty quickly, there weren't any terms available for me. But that alone wasn't it, so to speak. The understanding wasn't there yet. Because the next thing right with it is, but there's a hand here. It's like there's no hand. But there's a hand. When I've had these kind of religious experiences, I guess if that's what we want to call them, I don't know. I never went to, so I would sort of go, ooh, and kind of get out of it again. But this time I realized, but there's a hand. I didn't know it yet. I was studying Nagarjuna already on my own at this point. But this is what I didn't quite understand yet. When he talks about the two truths, this is what he's talking about. There's a hand. It's a relative thing. It's a graspable thing, literally, and also just the idea of a hand or my hand or something like this was already there. It's something different and distinct from other things, of all other hands, but also other, even just the smell of a rose. It's different from all sorts of things that we might otherwise separate out as something distinct and separate from other things. So there that is. In other words, just my ordinary mind or take on the world that I've always had, I guess, I don't know, far back as I remember anyway, that things are things. They really are. And then there's me, too. But if we were to take the time and just look at something, just sit quietly, don't think about it, don't try to describe it. If the description or the thought slides into your mind, if your mind is really quiet and you've practiced this a bit, you might realize how the closing down of everything and you dividing from it and separate from it, from the object, whatever it might be, not necessarily a physical thing, but even a thought, a belief. And this is what we're doing with our beliefs. We're taking these things that we think are true and real, including, say, the hand here, and making them distinct and separate. And this is Nagarjuna grants this is truth, but this is a small t truth, a small t. But there's something else going on there. It wasn't that I saw there's just really, I can't even say it, but it was so utterly real that there's no hand. And yet, here's a hand. That's like when I first encountered Zen, you know, mountains are mountains, and you know, hands are hands, and rivers are rivers. And then you realize that there's no mountains, no rivers, you know. And then finally, then we can see. And you can't say that there are mountains, rivers or hands. You can't say that there are not. So then what can you say? You can't say anything. If you say ah or something else, now we've boxed up the, and we're always there in this boxed up place unless we wake up to what the immediate direct experience is all the time. And this, there, now we find knowledge. I would give that knowledge with a capital K. Because otherwise we apply that word, I would give it a small K, to what we believe. To what we believe is true. This is what I know. I know, you know, that there's a flower out there in the other room. I can see it, you know. Yeah. Well, that's an idea. Do I believe that? Yeah, well, yeah. Not really, but that's something that takes us into another series of lectures, really. So I won't go there, because I don't think is not. But most of us remain caught there in that world of is, or and then we go to the other side, or is not. I just destroyed that. I just ate that. So it's no longer, you know. So there's, yeah, we live with that, is and is not. Nagarjuna points out, no, you can't say is, you can't say is not, you can't say both, and you can't say neither. And there's no fifth possibility, there's no fifth alternative. And this is what Nagarjuna brings us to, points out, and we can spend a few years looking at this, coming back. That's what I did. I was so gripped by this. And this is before I understood anything. There's an end with that hand experience. I wasn't even thinking about Nagarjuna. I hadn't been reading him in a while. That just happened. And I had many other experiences like that leading up to that. But I would, the moment they seemed a little spooky, I just would kind of shake myself loose and back to ordinary mind. But as I'm talking now, and I'm very reluctant to talk this way and to go very far with any of this, because I don't want you to grip anything here. That's not what this way is. That's not what this practice is. Our practice is just, because my experience, whatever it is, the odds of it match, well, it won't perfectly match anything that you could possibly have. It'll be different. Same thing with your experience of this or that. And when we talk to each other about our experiences and things like this, we better go very easy with this, because very quickly, you know, we're turning all of these different things, parts and whatever, connections, relationships, into real things, which is just our ordinary mind. That's back to mountains are mountains. It's just our ordinary mind. But this is different. The insights that the Buddha had and that Nagarjuna tries to help us see. Of course, we get confused trying to read on Nagarjuna because we keep putting everything in that first box or first place. We interpret it in that way. And then getting back when Tate had asked, like, well, we don't seem to use that word here, faith. Yes, I don't know why I'm blanking. But faith. Yeah, I don't use it very much, no. And I think you also said it's used kind of lightly in Buddhism in general. I think, yeah, that's probably the case. But again, within Buddhism, you can find people who say, forming it up into belief itself, you know. But here, when I use faith, I'm just referring to trust. And we can trust the immediate, direct experience, which does not give us anything to grip or to handle or to carry away in thinking this is real. There's something here, and I've got it too. I got it. I have enlightenment. Waking up isn't that you suddenly figure out the right concept or something like that, the right idea, the right belief. It's nothing like that at all. That's just a perpetuation of our ordinary mind, which does that with pretty much everything. So this is something quite different, you know, from all of that. So at least when I'm using the term faith, I'm just referring to, and it isn't just me, Nagarjuna will do the same, or other teachers as well who actually see this. But we just use that in terms of just having trust. And trust not as a gripped thing, but as kind of just confidence. And by the way, there's nothing mystical about any of this that I'm saying. This is important to understand. If you take what I'm saying and trying to think, but you're still looking at it through the lens of mountains are mountains. You think that there are things, and then I'm talking about something really mysterious. No, I'm talking about direct knowledge right here that we all have all the time. We're always directly tasting reality all the time. It's just that we think, we conceptualize the experience, and we go with those kinds of things that are grippable, that we take out of it. It's very useful. It's not that that's wrong, but if we need to know the nature of it, and so we don't get taken in by that. But it's not mysterious. In the same sense, as I've used that example over and over, of the orange juice. I mentioned it again last night. But the orange juice, because knowledge with a capital K is on that order. It's actually more subtle than this, because there's still a bit of an object involved with that. But it's just kind of pointing toward where we need to look. The knowledge that you actually have is of this sort. And if you think about it, the taste of orange, even though if you've had orange juice, and I'm sure probably all of us have, maybe you can conjure up. I guess some people can remember flavors and scents and things like this better than others and that sort of thing. But certainly if you go back and taste it again, oh yes, yeah. But we know this, but the knowledge that we have of this, but it's actually in the actual tasting itself. That knowledge is the knowledge I'm speaking of here with a capital K, except it really, that's still conceptual actually, but at a pretty subtle level now. So what I'm speaking of, the knowledge that you have, we all know with a capital K, reality with a capital R. Not the reality we put together, or the reality of relationships between this and that. Again, all of these things are helpful and important. We can't ignore them, that sort of thing. But the actual knowledge of the nature of this awakeness, this awareness, and this would be awareness with a capital A. It doesn't have objects. But that's another series of talks that I can't get into. But I've talked about all of this elsewhere at other times. But this direct knowing, now it's not a concept. It is not something you can put into words. That's why you cannot, you can try to describe the taste of orange juice to someone who's never tasted it. But good luck, you'll never have it occur in their mind, but what you're talking about, they need to taste it directly themselves. And that's where the knowledge will be. But of course, now you can discuss it and your reactions to the flavor or whatever, any number of things. But we spend all of our time there and then hoping that we can actually have this direct knowledge of reality through those means, because this is what we do. We immediately conceptualize our immediate direct experience, which is, that's all. I don't even want to, it neither comes nor goes, it's just. And either we see this and realize what we're seeing, or we don't. There's really nothing you can say. This is why in nearly 50 years now that I've seen this and understood this, I've tried to find for about 10 years, I never said anything, but then my teacher just wanted me to start talking more. But you can't put it into words. And that's what was stopping me for a long time. We can't say, if I could tell you in a few words what the truth is or something like that, I would have given it to you over and over again, described it, all of this, but it's nothing like that at all. And furthermore, this is also important to realize, whether you believe it or not or whatever, but just hear me say this and just let it go. But maybe you can reflect once in a while that something I'm going to say here. You have this knowledge with a capital K. There's a few things wrong with my putting it that way, but not in a way that will harm you at this point with what I'm trying to bring out. What I'm trying to bring out here is that this isn't something you need to go after. It's not something you need to figure out. It's not something you need to... do anything about. You're sitting in it now, this knowledge, this reality. But you're conceptualizing it, and that's why we keep missing it. We're putting it into little graspable parts, and then we keep thinking about that. Well, then does this mean what? And there we are. And thus, we don't pay attention to what's immediately just thus. And it's a matter of, at some point, finally seeing that. And in my case, I could see that there was no hand thoroughly. I could see that there's a hand. Yeah. And for some reason, then it's a matter of, I can't say that there is, because it looks like there isn't. I can't say that there isn't, because it looks like there is. And it is in that. And finally, so what do I say? I was speechless. And then I realized, not only I don't have to, I can't say anything. And it's been close to 50 years now for me. And I can tell you, you might think, well, then how do you get along in the world and find your way home? Or no problem. Well, I don't want to start praising anything, because that's just putting stuff into boxes, and I don't want to do that. So when you asked, why is this word faith? Yeah, it seems to be kind of used in strange ways. There's plenty of Buddhist teachings out there, or Buddhist teachers, or even books, where this point of Nagarjuna's, the two truths mainly, is not understood. And there are plenty of people who, and actually even very fine teachers I've known too, but who will even argue against things like, I was almost going to give you an example, but I don't want to say who, but pretty well-known person. But this is subtle stuff, and can't really talk about it directly. So I've been spending all this time trying to find ways to say something, knowing that I can't actually say it. But maybe I can convey some sense in you of what it is we need to notice. And otherwise, everything's fine, but watch your mind, the entanglements and the anger and sorrow and the fear, all of that is you're dealing with this conceptualized stuff. At some point, if you just look at a bird. Well, a bird hops around, but a flower, whatever. It doesn't have to be something even beautiful necessarily. Just an old stump left of an old wooden fence that has now rotted and fallen apart. Just look at that. Just look at it. Of course, another thing with us too, our minds immediately, we start thinking about stuff. Oh, I got to go home and do such and such. And we have this practice where we sit. Don't put a lot in front of you to look at. We don't close our eyes. We don't stare. And we watch the mind. Things will come up. You know this. Those of you who've been meditating a bit, stuff comes up. And you may think, well, I have to blank my mind. No, that's not what this is about. Your mind probably over time will get quieter and more settled and stuff like that. But still, I've been doing this well over 60 years. And stuff comes up in my mind. And sometimes maybe I might work with it a bit, but there's the opportunity now to just let it go and it'll go. But it's like that. And then we think we do this practice so that we can wake up. No, the awakening is already with you right now. No, we just do this because one who's awake isn't going to be playing with too much in their mind. That's what the awakeness is. Well, that and the understanding of what is taking place. But we don't do this to get that. You already have that. So it's something else. But we practice it. And at first, this practice is what Dogen refers to as learning meditation in his Fukan Zazengi. But then he's speaking of, I'm not speaking of learning meditation. I'm speaking of the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. But don't make that a thing now, forget all of that. Now just sit down. Don't be disturbed by whatever's coming up in your mind, Don't chase it. Don't hang on to it. Well, if for some reason you determine, I got to think this through in 10 minutes after, so I got to go do such and such, whatever, okay. You can be discerning in that way. But otherwise, just sit there. And you don't have to do this in a Zendo, but it's pretty good. It's also very important in Zazen. My teacher, Katagiri, he wanted me to decipher this. It was in Chinese anyway, never mind. But he's pointing out how the character for Zazen was two people sitting on the earth. That's Zazen. So it's kind of encouraging us. You don't have to run off to the forest by yourself or something. You can. That's perfectly fine. But to get together as a group of people engaged in the same activity, that's very conducive to just letting the mind settle and to learn to not be disturbed or wondering about that person there or this or what they might think or say or what am I wearing or any of that kind of stuff. You can learn to just sit there and just let it go. And that's all. But the learning meditation is finally we can learn to just sit there. And Dogen says, I'm speaking of the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. So anyway, maybe I've said enough here. In judgment, also some of the places I went off in kind of response to what you had brought up, because Jasmine was in on this too a bit. Okay, so did that help there? Yeah, okay. Thank you, yeah, because I was at a loss last night. I would have come up with something, I suppose. Yeah, David.
This is from Shin Chen Hing.
Oh, yes.
When all things are seen equally, timeless, thus as itself is reached. With a unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases.
Yeah.
Doubts and irresolutions vanish faith is confirmed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is trust. We can trust in this. We can have confidence in this. And the reason we can have that absolutely assured confidence is because we're not holding anything. It's only when we hold something or grip something, believe something, and want to argue this point or that point, now we're on shaky ground. And we live out our lives this way and build out our different societies and cultures this way too. And we fight wars and we fight each other, and even within our own mind, we fight ourselves. So this is, just look at this. I don't know what I can say beyond what I've said now, but it is a matter of just looking at this. Also, trusting the heart, mind, well, xinxing, in that word, well, there's two different xin. In Chinese, there's a lot of homophones, yes. You know, so they repeat a lot. In Japanese, is even worse in terms of homophones. But so that first shin is, because I've seen it translated as believing the heart, mind, or something like this. But believing is, we believe ideas. You can't believe this. When we wake up to what's there, there's nothing to believe. There's literally nothing to believe. It's the lack of confusion about what's actually happening. That's what it is. And that's the thing that we don't believe in that, because it's forming it into something now. It's trust. So a better translation of that would then be trusting the heart, and the other one is heart-mind. And in Ming, it's just a document, a written document of some sort, Xinxing Ming. So trusting heart-mind, or trust in heart-mind. Something on that order. And then the opening line, too, how is it the great way has... Well, I've seen it where the great way has no difficulties for those who have no preferences. But that's wrong. That's loaded with all kinds of gripped ideas there. It's the great way itself is not difficult. There's nothing it prefers. It has no preferences, you know. How does that differ from our own mind, which is going here and chasing from, you know, that or what... Preferences all over the place. And it isn't like, well, get rid of your preferences. I don't know if you can do that. That's not the point. But stop doing those things that stress those things or exacerbate those things or make them stronger or whatever. When we begin to see in terms of the whole, what's to prefer? So eventually all of that kind of stuff drops away. But that's just a symptom of our believing mind or grasping mind, this kind of... preference and stuff like that, and being bothered by that, because things are, you know, I might have some mild preferences with this or that, and then, you know, I'm looking for a strawberry sundae, and they give me a pineapple one, and then, oh, you know, I would have preferred the strawberry, but, you know, but it's about as important as that, and I'm not going to live my life getting caught up in such things. But still, preferences will still come up, even now for me. They're not like they were when I was younger, that's for sure. But those sorts of things happen, and I just look at it. I've learned maybe not to judge myself or scold myself or, look, Steve, there you did it again. You can't do that. Just pay attention from moment to moment and do what's appropriate in the moment as it seems to be coming up. So it's a very simple life. It's a very simple way to live. And we need to practice it without a lot of ideas. Just get rid of ideas. And so I hope, too, I didn't give you a lot of ideas today, you know. So, okay. Was there anything else? Yes?
Is
there any
Ferraro has a question?
Oh, sure. Okay.
Good morning, Steve.
Morning.
So, I guess my question is, what is it to be awake? Because in our Buddhist practice, I think, if I'm not mistaken, our effort should be to be awake and, you know, let go of the ego mind. And,
yeah.
And so, is to be awake, if I had to put it in some words, would you say, Steve, it's just to, you know, direct experience, the immediate experience?
Yeah, we can say things like that, but to say what it is, it isn't anything in particular that we can put a label on. So even to say it's direct experience, yeah, but the fact, as soon as I say direct, well, that's a relative term. We can arguing all sorts of things about that and experience. Yeah, well, there's all sorts of experience or things that we might confuse with experience. So anytime we start using words, now we're opening ourselves up to the grand debates and all of this, as opposed to attending to our own mind, where we're going to realize that we actually know. And when we get in touch with what it is that's known, it isn't you know or I know or we know. But with this knowledge, there's nothing to debate, nothing to label, and there's nothing unclear. It's all very clear. It's not scary. It's not unstable. You can go about living your life now. We have bodies, so we have to feed them and, you know, stuff like this and exercise, you know. But also be attentive to what might be hurtful to others, you know, in various ways, things that you could cause or maybe allow to happen because of your carelessness. Or, you know, just be aware of these things. If you realize you've slipped on that one, I didn't do anything about that, and then you start scolding, that's not necessary. Because now what are you doing? Just realize what you're doing, and then just see if you can just stop that. But as to then what is it? I don't know. What's to say? So you say something, now that's a thing, but that's not what this is. That's what's so difficult about this, because we keep wanting to get a grip on it. We keep wanting to get the idea of it. So what is enlightenment like? Well, actually, if you pay very careful attention, you already know. But we'll try to make something of it, or explain it to somebody else. And if we really believe that, really think of this, that's all the confusion. Once again, that's everything I've been talking about. It's right there. So it's kind of frustrating. I do understand those individuals who just go off by themselves, and you know, no one ever hears from them again, and they know how to live off the trees or whatever that where. I wish I could do that sometimes, but here we are. You know, and I want to help people, but I also realize that there's delusional aspects of that too. So I just have to keep. But I feel compelled to still say something, even after I went through a long period where I didn't think I could say anything. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's another question? No? Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.